Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to a very special edition of the Empire Podcast. Very special and very sad indeed. Earlier today, the news broke that the legendary Sir Roger Moore, the third and for many the best James Bond, had died at the age of 89. We loved Sir Roger here at Empire. He was always friendly and generous to us. He had a treasure trove of amazing anecdotes and he was the epitome of class. And so when we started thinking of a way to pay suitable tribute to the great man, we remembered that he'd come to our pod booth way back in 2012, back when the podcast was in its infancy, for a long interview, really long interview, that covered pretty much every aspect of his illustrious career, from Bond to non-Bond alike. And we even got to ask about his perfect Christmas dinner. Now, for reasons that escape us, this podcast seems to have disappeared from iTunes, so we've decided to present it to you again. So, pour yourself a dry martini, shaken, not stirred, and raise your eyebrow to the highest mass possible as Neil Alcock, Nick Desemlian, and I talk to the late, great Sir Roger Moore. I say this all the time on the Empire Podcast. I always say we're delighted to be joined in the pod booth by such and such, but in this case, it is a genuine delight and an honour to be joined by Sir Roger Moore on the Empire Podcast. Hello, sir.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Drop the sir.
Of course. Yeah.
Call me Charlie.
So, Charlie, you're now on this is your third book, Bond on Bond. I mean, you wrote a Live and Let Die diary.
Yes.
Which was taken from your diaries during the making of the film?
During the making of Live and Let Die. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was the publicity department's idea that I should record my day's thoughts. Mm-hmm. So some days I had clean thoughts and some days I didn't, and they put them all together and produced... there were things they edited out because they said the children might read this. I think I probably spoke about diarrhea or something. But anyway,
was that a problem?
That is life.
and then that wasn't repeated. But then you wrote "My Word Is My Bond," and now "Bond on Bond."
Yes,
which is about the whole franchise itself. And you once said you wouldn't really talk about the other Bonds and the other Bond movies. So what changed your mind?
Well, I couldn't write about Bond over 50 years without writing about the other Bonds. Mark you, I hadn't seen Skyfall. Mm-hmm. And I really would like to add a couple of pages.
Okay.
Talk about how great Skyfall is and how it's going to guarantee the franchise going on for at least another 50 years. And the right Bond, the right time, but really a great Bond, is Daniel Craig. Mm-hmm. Really, really great film.
Might be wrong, but I believe there's a Live and Let Die reference in there in the form of Daniel Craig kind of jumping onto the Komodo dragons in that pit. Was that? Did you think that was a reference to the
Yes, it was. I had a quick flashback.
Yeah. He wasn't wearing the crocodile shoes, the alligator skin shoes that you were wearing.
He couldn't have had lizard shoes. What was he jumped on? A lizard?
I think they were Komodo dragons.
Right? Komodo dragons.
Oh,
yeah.
Komodo dragons. Oh, the worst. Oh. Yeah, you couldn't. Yeah, I don't think you can get shoes. No, that was a pretty sick mistake on my part, suggesting that I should wear crocodile shoes when running over them.
Did you get a lot of flack?
Well, no, because there were 1,500 those terrible beasts there, mm-hmm. and one of them was related to those shoes. They carry an odour, and those nasty eyes that they have.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, I did a film called Shot of the Devil, and we shot that in Africa. In South Africa and on the Umzivubu River, mm-hmm. which is sharks go upstream in it, or upriver. and there's a lot of crocodiles, and we had a scene where very close to the crocodile's mouth, and they had a fake crocodile with a man inside. And it was a stuntman who was inside. And there was terrible sort of strangulated screams coming from inside. He suddenly had terrible claustrophobia.
Oh, my word.
I also think he had the fear that he was a male false crocodile or a female, and either a gay crocodile was going to come along or a male crocodile for that matter, and give him a good time. That's why frogs make those noises, because they cannot tell what the sex is of the frog they've jumped on. And so they jump on the wrong one, and he says, get off, get off. And that's what you hear all night long in the swamp, get off, get off.
I was wondering if the man in the fake crocodile inspired the gag in Octopussy where you hid inside a crocodile.
No, that was... I don't think the inspiration came from that. It was like, it looked like a real crocodile, the one we'd had in Octopussy. Mm. But there were a couple of crocodiles rolling around, which again was quite worrying.
Yeah.
It was a day of absolute horror, I remember, because it was between Christmas and New Year. And Cubby said, Roger, we have to get all these shots, and if you can do them, now you can have a long Christmas. I said, what shots do we have to do? There was a thing with a snake crawling up my leg as I hide in bushes, then running through awful spider's webs, and then in with the crocodile. It was all in one day. It was no wonder that I became slim while I was making up for it now. I could hardly get through the door of the studio.
Rewatching Live and Let Die is a fantastic experience, because your first shot, the very first shot of you as James Bond, yeah, is very instructive, because you start as you mean to go on in bed with a girl. Because was the idea that your Bond all along would be more of a lover than a fighter? And
yeah, I'm a lover. Sean was a killer. Daniel Craig is a real killer. Mm.
Was there a deliberate kind of intention to make yours, to distance your Bond from Sean straight away? So you weren't even in the pre-credit scene, but you were immediately joking around with the young lady.
It was deliberately planned that I wouldn't. Guy Hamilton had directed so that I should not do things associated with Sean, except I had to be Bond. The one thing, martini shaken, not stirred, I never ever said in a Bond. Mm. And the only one I worried about was that I would come up with, my name is James Bond, you know, but I've managed to avoid doing that.
I'm curious, your preparation for Bond on Bond, did you sit down and rewatch all of the Bond movies again?
No, my assistant, Gareth, I work with all the time, and I've been doing this tour with him, asking me questions. He knows the answers to the question, because he knows more about me, more about Bond than I know. And he is very good at doing all the research. And then we put it all together.
But were there any of the Bond films that you hadn't seen for a while that you particularly kind of came back to and thought, wow, I'm going to dig that and watch that?
Well, what I saw, because my wife has not seen all the Bonds, so I had to show her. And then Living Daylights was playing on television, and I showed her that, which I thought was a damn good film. Mm. And John Glenn had really established himself as a good Bond director, I think. He did it was A View to a Kill, and
he did Your Last Three, yeah.
Fiore's, mm-hmm. Yeah, his. And I worked with him as a second unit director. I used to call him Glenn the actor killer, because when he was directing second unit, it was sort of, you know, yeah, well, that was quite good, but maybe we should go again, you know. And, oh God, I'm tired. This time I'm going to fall over and I won't be able to get out of the way. I remember we were shooting a scene again on Shout of the Devil, which he was doing the second unit. And Lee Marvin and I and his daughter were out to get the Germans, and they are rolling steel plates on giant wheels across Africa to repair the Blucher battleship, which has been hauled. And they, hundreds of people towing these enormous things. And then when Lee, who's up the hill, starts shooting at them, some fall and the wheels start to roll. I'm at the bottom of the hill. When I got down there, I looked up and I thought, these giant wheels are coming down, weighing tons. And they come straight at me and at the camera. And I said, but they're going to end up in the tree down over trees over on my left, where half of the African crew were sheltering. I said, that is where the wheel will end up on them. They should be cleared. And I had to be in front of the camera as the thing comes down. And my own judgment when to leave, which should have also been on a cue from behind the camera. It never came. No cue came. I looked around. The whole camera crew gone there, running up the side of the hill to get out of the way of this damn wheel. I survived. Anyway, so we called him John. He was a wonderful second unit director because he was a great editor who worked with Peter Hunt.
Mm.
Peter Hunt was the editor on the first Bond, Dr. No. And he, in his cutting, he really established the style that Bond was to follow. And John Glenn was his assistant. Peter Hunt unfortunately died. He directed one Bond, which was a very good, very good direction on a Majesty's Secret Service.
Indeed. I mean, you worked with three directors over seven Bond films.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, Guy Hamilton, Lewis Gilbert, and John Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
What differences do they bring to your portrayal? Because every director has a different idea of how a character should act and behave, and did that ever mesh with what you...
Clash? They'd done so many television series. I really don't need telling what the character is doing. I know, you know, so nobody ever told me to do anything. It was just as well, because I'd be argumentative. you know, it's easy. I play myself. You know, everything comes out like me, good, bad, and different. Lewis Gilbert, I really loved, because he would say, you know, what are we going to say today, dear? I said, what's the script say? He said, well, let's see if we can find something we like better. And he had the same idiotic sense of humor that I did. And so we would experiment and shoot four or five, six different lines, throwaway lines, and see what the reaction was in the viewing theater when we showed it to the crew.
Mm-hmm.
When you went back to revisit your films with several decades kind of hindsight, is there anything that struck you as you wished you'd done it differently, or you didn't like the way you'd done something?
Yeah, everything I do.
Every single thing.
You know, you think that can only be improved upon. No, but talking about playing oneself, I remember a cartoon of George Arliss, who was a great star of the 20s and 30s, and he played historic characters, Disraeli, etc., and he's having a nightmare and he's surrounded by all these historic characters as he's playing, and they're pointing their finger at him and saying, and what's more, you made us sound like you. so I'm guilty of the same thing.
I love the W innuendos that come up in your Bond films. Some of them are really quite risque. Who was kind of pushing that element of it forward? Were you all kind of...
The first, Richard Maybaum and Tom Mankiewicz did a few. And Tom Mankiewicz wrote some great one-liners. One, my favorite, I think, being when I am questioning the gunsmith.
Oh, this is Macau. From The Man with the Golden Gun.
Yeah, in Macau. And he's got a rifle on a stand, and I drop the sights down to his crotch. And I say, speak now or forever hold your peace. I saw a TV version of it, an American TV version of it, and they cut it.
Oh, no.
They cut the line. Apparently, Americans get upset by the word peace.
Did you ever get to contribute a line, one of those one-liners, or did you leave that to the wordsmiths?
Well, yeah, some of them I forget which I did. You say them so often.
Attempting re-entry
is
on that.
I do remember. No, that was there. I remember John Glender when we were doing Octopussy, and I'm confronted by a tiger coming out of the bush, and the script says, "Here, good pussy, good kitty." That won't work. And so John said, "Well, what are you going to say?" I said, "I should go sit." He said, "Well, that's not funny." I said, "John, there's a famous lady called Barbara Woodhouse who trains animals, and she always says, sit, raising her finger." And he says, "Yeah, but that's in England." I said, "It's shown in America. It's shown worldwide." It was in. They didn't let me do a couple of things, like drop my trousers when walking across the desert with Barbara Bartlett.
You were quite mischievous with Desmond Llewellyn as well, weren't you? I've read that you used to try and put him off as much as possible when he had his complicated speeches to do.
Well, I'd rewrite his dialogue and make sure that the director gave it to him before the take, when he'd spent 2 months learning this terrible dialogue he had. And I wrote even worse, unintelligible dialogue. And we'd give it to him, and he'd say, "Oh," and then he'd look at me and he'd see me. He's struggling to get these lines out. And I'm going, and he's thinking, "God, this swine of an actor, laughing, and I'm sweating." And then I start roaring laughter, and the director, all of us in the know. But he was a lovely man, Desmond.
Did he ever get you back for any of that?
No, it wasn't in his nature. He was very forgiving. No, he was a lovely man. The other thing we used to do was get him back. I knew that he hated wearing shorts, because he'd worn them in one film with Sean. Mm-hmm. And I would say, "Lewis, don't you think it will work better as we're sort of in the heat?" Desmond would have shorts. He said, "What?" Oh, no. No, but he was a sweet man, sweet man.
And I gather that Cubby Broccoli was a bit of a prankster himself. Did you fall victim to any of his...
Cubby was my backgammon partner, opponent. We played backgammon continually all through each film and kept a book. And we would settle up at the end of the movie. It would get to hundreds of thousands. And then he'd say, "Well, the stake was now 200,000. So knowing that odds are that at one point you've got to win, and reduce it down to two or 300, not with the zeros after them. And that's how we'd always pay up on the last day of shooting.
Right.
He was a very generous man, Cubby. The crews loved him. He was one of those producers that are thoughtful. And when we were in places like Macau, where there was a casino, and Cubby loved to gamble, that's where I'd met him, in a casino in London in the 60s. Mm. And he would not let the crew take all their salary when we were in places where they could lose money. He wanted them to have some money when they finished the movie, went home. But he would go around the casino, and in front of his boys, he would put a stack of chips. He was absolutely lovely.
I spoke to Sam Mendes the other day, who directed Skyfall, obviously, and he said very similar things about Barbara Broccoli, that she really looks after the crew on the set.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the Broccoli trait. Yeah, Barbara does a wonderful job. And Sam Mendes, he does a wonderful job with Skyfall.
Mm. Mm. Fantastic. What did you think of the new Q, Ben Whishaw?
He is quite extraordinary. It's such a shock. I don't think we should talk about things that... Yeah. Oh, no,
it's out on Friday, so yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Friday, the premiere last night. I couldn't go, I was playing Basingstoke.
Oh,
no, no, I mean, I was playing basics. In fact, I said to the audience last night when I came out, I said, you're only here because you couldn't get an invite to the premiere.
How is the theatre tour going, is it?
They've been going very well. They believe the lies I tell them.
Do you believe them? That's the key.
The thing is that Garrett, who does it with me, and mm-hmm. sort of knows the answers to any question, and he throws things at me, and then he... And before we start, he says, the format will be that we will talk for maybe 30, 40 minutes, and then we'll take questions. The only question you cannot ask is, who's your favourite Bond girl? Because that is an inevitable question.
What's the most peculiar question you've been asked during these...
David Walliams. Right. David Walliams came down... to do an article for Vanity Fair, and he came down to Monaco, and he said, you know, you sort of let out the challenge to find a question you've never been asked. He said, I'll ask you one. Was Christopher Lee really the official hangman for the British Army at Nuremberg?
Crikey.
And?
Well, Christopher used to have a little string with a noose on it, and he would say that he was Pierpont's assistant.
Okay.
I don't know. he's an amazing character. I first met him in 1948 when I'd just come out of the army, and he was, we were 30 of us, stage door Johnnies, in a film called Trotty True with Gene Kent. Mm. And so with 30 struggling young actors sharing a large dressing room at Denham Studios. And Christopher said, if you'd been in the forces with me, you'd have stood to attention any time you spoke to me. And there was another one of the boys in the room, Charles Houston, who had been in the army with me. And he says, shall I nobble him for you? I said, no, no, leave him. Then Christopher and I worked in an episode of Ivanhoe. He played Otto the Hun. And then, of course, Scaramanga.
Indeed.
We'd see one another around a lot of times, see him in various places where they make films, like Rome. I don't know, sometimes Christopher, I'm not sure whether he's fantasizing, but he has the most amazing photographic memory.
Yeah.
He can, you give him a book and he, you say page 33, and he will quote the first line of the second paragraph if you ask.
Wow.
It's amazing.
I've seen him reciting Lord of the Rings on the sort of behind the scenes of that film, just quoting a huge passage from that book. I'm curious if you keep up with modern cinema. Have you seen Christopher act in the Lord of the Rings films? Did you see Michael Caine in Inception? Do you get to go out and do you follow that stuff?
What was Inception?
Oh, it's by a director called Christopher Nolan. It came out 2 years ago?
2 years ago, 2009.
It was quite Bond.
Big science fiction film about dreams within dreams. And Michael Caine had a very small role as a kind of professor in that.
I don't think I saw it.
Okay.
Right. I've seen most things Michael does.
Mm-hmm. It's very good. It is very good. But Christopher Lee and yourself, you were participants recently in Everything or Nothing, that great documentary about Bond. All the Bonds are in that documentary except for one, Sean. And I read an interview with you recently where you said that Sean doesn't really want to participate in...
No, he's trying to dissociate himself from mm-hmm. Bond. I think Sean resented the fame, the celebrity that he gave him. He didn't want to be known as Mr. Bond mm-hmm. and his wife be called Mrs. Bond. I say, get on with it, you know.
So that means we will. Has there ever been a point then when all of you might be in the same room together? Has that ever happened, or might that ever happen?
No. If there's been the same premiere and the same lineup with Pierce Brosnan and George Lazenby and Timothy Dalton mm-hmm. for the 40th anniversary. Mm-hmm. But we don't hear people say, do you think? All you Bonds get together, you have a club, secret handshakes.
I'd like to ask you, because James Bond, and specifically your James Bond, very, very well-dressed characters in the films, and I just wondered what input you had into any choice of costume, because I know you were always incredibly well-dressed and you enjoyed working with tailors like Cyril Castle and Dougie Hayward, and I just wondered if you said to Eon that you would like to work with those people or if they kind of put them onto you.
No, I would say I would like, and Cyril Castle did my first Bond. He did all the clothes all through The Saint and through The Persuaders. So, you know, they don't object to that, you know, because they know he's your tailor. And in fact, the Cyril Castle has just been bought because Cyril's dead. And on Sunday we had a luncheon, about 150 people at Pinewood, and did a little talk. And there was a raffle, and the prize was a suit made by Anthony Sinclair, who and Cyril Castle. They've opened up again. These gentlemen have bought the names, and they're going to make the clothes. And they're using the patterns, and so the raffle prize was a suit by Cyril Castle.
Wow. Did you get to keep any of your suits from the films?
Stole everything. No, but anyway, they're also making me a suit, but I have to go and get a fitting first.
Ah. Okay. And what about the, I guess the safari suit? Was Cyril behind this? That iconic safari suit that you wore?
The safari suit was Dougie Hayward. I enjoyed. You know, people joke about wearing the safari suit, but I enjoyed. You know, I made films in Africa, and I know that's the sort of clothing you wear. You've got to be able to breathe.
That's very good. If I could get away with wearing one, I would wear one.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you can pull it off, which is amazing.
Well, I don't think I'm going to walk around London.
I don't know. I think we should bring it back.
In the summer.
In the summer, yes. Yeah, it's a new fashion. But going back, Roger, to your, or Charlie, sorry, going back to the idea about your Bond being a lover, not a fighter. Mm-hmm. And that being something that you very much wanted to do yourself, was that because you found the fight scenes distasteful? You didn't enjoy doing them?
Oh, I like the fight scenes. I didn't like the love scenes. I always had a double for that. No, people say, well, you know, what's it like? You know, when you do all these great love scenes in bed. Well, there's not much romance about it. You know, you usually shoot on a Monday morning on a cold set. The studio's been closed for the weekend, and you sort of keep a pair of woolly socks on and get under the sheets. And it's very difficult to be romantic when you've got 60 sparks on the rail above you, all looking down saying, "Go on, kill all one, Roach!" But, you know, you just make jokes all the time.
I gather the Grace Jones sex scene was particularly unromantic, going from what I read in your book.
I find it a policy that when you can find very little good to say about it, well, you shouldn't say it.
Okay. You did obliquely reference what went down in the book, but we won't go into it in a polite podcast.
There's one of those things in life, you know.
Is this one of the reasons why you don't like that question? Who's your favourite Bond girl? You want to avoid that?
You know, because that leads to who did you like least?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't go down that route. You know, first of all, if you say, "Oh, this lady was my favourite," the others will read it or hear it and say, "Well, what was wrong with me? Well, I was very nice." Yeah. But I will say that Maud Adams did too. The only actress that came back, but not as the same character, of course. But Maud was wonderful, on time. Didn't need her makeup changed all the time. Didn't have to go and have her hair done, which you get, which is...
it's notable, for example, we don't want to dwell on Grace Jones, obviously, but it's notable that she was present in your last Bond film. Was she instrumental in your decision to hang up the Walther, or was that something that you were already about thinking about?
I was thinking about it. Uh-huh. I made up my mind.
talking of You to a Kill, Christopher Walken's in that, and he's an actor that I really like. Yeah. Was he one of the most fun Bond villains to work with?
I loved Chris. I don't know whether you know an actor called Sheldon Leonard, who usually played Chicago gangsters. Mm-hmm. And he spoke, and I sit to shut my eyes and listen to Chris, and he sounds exactly like him. Sheldon Leonard. We were talking one day. He came and stayed. He and his wife came and stayed with us in Stadt at Christmas, and we were talking about the things that where we'd started and everything else. And in 1952, I'd gone to New York for the first time, and I worked on a show called Robert Montgomery Presents a couple of times. And Chris was a child and was in one of those episodes, one of those plays. So we actually worked together before.
Did he remember?
No, but we worked out that he must have been there.
He's a very keen cook. Did he cook anything for you while he was staying over? Or
No, nobody goes in my kitchen. I do the cooking.
Do you have a signature dish?
Traditional English. Roast beef, Yorkshire pudding, roast lamb. Do a lot of wok food. Christmas is... I'm forbidden, actually, this year, because my wife says that I tire myself because cooking for a large number of people, stuffing the turkey, making the stuffing, making the brandy butter, and preparing all the vegetables, putting a little cross at the bottom of each Brussels sprout. It takes time, and you stand, and we have heated floors, and I think all that heat goes up through my feet. But I enjoy cooking, and I think people... Well, nobody dare complain.
No, of course not.
Bond.
I'd like to ask you about a non-Bond film from your past, which is one of my favourites of all of your films. It's called The Man Who Haunted Himself.
Oh.
1970, I think, directed by Basil Dearden.
Yep.
What are your memories of that? Because that's an extraordinary film.
I'm so pleased you brought that up. It's the only film I think I've ever done where I was allowed to act.
Yeah.
We don't have to agree so readily.
Well, I was just... Yes. The reason that I say it like that is because you play effectively two roles.
Yeah, I play my evil other self. That wasn't acting. That was me. Bianca was the nice guy. But Basil was a wonderful, wonderful director. And we had a lovely cast. There was a terrible coincidence on the film. The beginning of the film, I have the car accident, the Rover that becomes a Lamborghini and then becomes a Rover and it smashes on the M4. And 2 years later, when I was doing Persuaders, Basil directed a few of the episodes. And one night he was leaving the studio and he had a crash in exactly the same spot that we shot the accident on the M4. And unfortunately, he was decapitated.
Oh, dear.
Awful, awful day.
Did you, when you were filming that and you got a chance to play a character very much unlike your usual characters, did you relish the chance to do that, to play Bad Roger?
Yeah, it's easy. Don't have to wash.
Well, I thought you did a spectacular job.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to ask... I'm a big fan of the comedy character Alan Partridge, and I was pleased to read that you have seen the episode in which...
I did. My father said to me, and he said, I'm very disappointed in you, son. I said, what's that? He said, you were supposed to be on television last night. He said, you never showed up. I said, what are you talking about? And he explained. I asked my then secretary, and she told me what the episode was about, and then eventually I saw it. And I said, Dad, it was that was the joke that I'm not showing you, but it's very bad. You shouldn't do that sort of thing.
And there's a later episode in which he sort of acts out the opening sequence from Spy Who Loved Me, same character.
Oh, yeah,
so there's this real affection for you in that.
I think he's very, very funny. Good stuff.
And on that show, on Alan Partridge, Rob Brydon does your voice. There's a point where Roger calls Alan.
Oh yes,
and it's Rob Brydon who does impersonates
you. Yeah, he did my voice in a film they made together,
Cock and Bull Story. Yeah, it's fantastic. What's your how do you rate Rob Brydon's Roger Moore?
Makes me sound better than I am. I think people say, "Do you mind image?"
Spitting image.
No, the more Mickey they take out of you, the more flattered you are. You know, politicians would beg to be sent up on it, made them famous.
I remember your puppet on that had an arched eyebrow. Yeah, eyebrow. It was about here, but it was up here somewhere.
Yeah, that was my fault. I was asked once in an interview about my acting ability, and I said, "Yeah, three expressions." Left eyebrow up, right eyebrow up, and both of them up together. And it stuck with me. You know. My agent was saying, you must stop saying these terrible things about yourself.
You've been doing it here as well. I mean, you talk about how you were only allowed to act in The Man Who Haunted Himself. Yeah. But did you not feel you got to act as Bond? I mean, you said you played yourself, but there were, for your eyes only, there are moments in that are quite...
Yes, you look brave. And you look adoringly at people. You try not to blink, firing guns. Yeah, that's all acting.
Talking about the Bonds getting back together and or being a club of Bonds, I believe that George Lazenby is in your email friends list.
Yeah.
Did you email him jokes and funny things you find on the internet?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I don't know. I like George.
Mm-hmm.
I met him when he was doing Bond. And he was getting all this dreadful publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, you know, you're not doing yourself any favor. I said, try behaving in a decent way. And he said, you're right. You're absolutely right. You're right, sport. He said. And next day he was at it again. But Cubby asked him why he behaved like that when they were making the film. And he said, because Harry Saltzman told me to behave like a movie star. I mean, he thought the movie star sent the car back for Rude Nate Garlick before kissing Diana Reeve.
And how about Sean? When did you last see him?
A couple of years ago. Sean doesn't come over that often. You know, he lives in the Bahamas.
Oh, did you see him there, or did he come visit you, or how did that?
No, we had meals together. And we used to see more of one another in California when I was living there, and he had a place.
So when you were Bond, obviously you didn't act the way George Lazenby acted when he was Bond. Were you aware of your responsibilities? Did you think of yourself as a role model for people, or...?
No, I behave as I always do, try to be polite. I had parents who were very strict with me about manners.
Mm-hmm.
One thing was, you know, if a neighbour asked you to run an errand, you were not to accept any money for it. And I, one of my Saturday morning pick up an extra pocket money jobs was working with the United Dairies milkman, go on his rounds with him, and they had to go knock on somebody's door for them to pay the bill, and it was an old lady, and she, her bill was about penny three farthings or something, and she gave me tuppence, and I came back with the farthings. She said, "No, you keep it, sonny." And I said, "No, I can't do it." "Oh, it's not bloody good enough for you, is it?" "Oh, I see. Right, little snob you are." And I tried to say, my mother says I mustn't take money. But there you are. I will take money. Thank you very much.
I'm afraid you've come to the wrong place. We don't have a lot of money here, sadly, but we will have to let you go. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's
thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Moore.
I hope we do it again.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
I hope I get another job. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was really, very exciting.
Thank you. Oh.
And there you have it. That is our From the Archives podcast special interview with the late, great Sir Roger Moore. What a legend. If you like that and you don't already subscribe to the Empire Podcast, you can do so via iTunes. And do keep an eye out for more podcast specials coming your way, including spoiler specials for the likes of Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge, Wonder Woman, Baby Driver, and more. Thanks for listening. I've been Chris Hewitt. Goodbye.